Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of June. The co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas, Kevin Merida, is with us this hour. Kevin is the associate editor at The Washington Post. He has been a national political reporter for the paper, a feature writer for its style section, and a columnist for the Post Sunday magazine. He was named a Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists in the year 2000. Did I say that? He was also a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal in the early 1980s. And so I'm sure that many of you are familiar with his writing from quite a few years ago. This book about Clarence Thomas is a fascinating read because he's a complex man. He's not an uninteresting man, as the authors say, maddening sometimes, but certainly not uninteresting. The book examines Thomas's entire life, and it relies heavily on the racial prism, for that is the prism, they write, through which Thomas often views himself. He is in constant struggle with his racial identity. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Kevin, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read. I mean, I can see why you were drawn to this guy, because there's this aura of mystery about him, those hearings that were never really resolved. We always wondered who was telling the truth, his background, the fact that he creates such passion, anger among some people, question marks among some people. He's a compelling figure.
Yes, I think you've hit exactly on the reason why we decided to undertake the project. I mean, it dates back to, for us, 2001, when we were doing a magazine piece in the Washington Post magazine on Thomas. And the reason we, you know, embarked on that, this was before the book, was, you know, we would often be out. Mike and I both had spent a lot of time around government. We'd covered pretty much every level of government. We really thought that Justice Thomas was perhaps the most fascinating figure in public life, precisely because he drew such strong opinions. There are really no soft opinions on him. I mean, and we would be in social occasions sometimes, and his name would be invoked, and it would everybody would kind of jump in. I remember one specific occasion, a party of black professionals, and I think Mike just had harmlessly, you know, just said, well, I think that whatever you think of Thomas, you know, he really believes these opinions. And just that comment alone, you know, prompted kind of an improvisational debate. People come from across the room to participate.
Oh my.
And that was very, that was the reason why we decided to take on the project.
Yeah. You know, you read about his early life, and there is an element of such sadness about it, isn't there? I mean, where's daddy? Where's his dad? And in some way it explains, to me at least, some measure of who he is.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, his dad left him when he was 2 years old. His dad is now dead, by the way, died several years ago. Thomas did attend the funeral. He's always had a kind of, like much of his family background, he's had a very, you know, complex relationship with members of his family. I mean, his dad left him when he was two, and his mother was not really able to raise him as a single mother very well, and she appealed to her father, who ironically had not been involved in her life very much. And his grandfather is the person who raised him, and it's really the only male figure, the first and only male figure in his life, and it had a profound impact on him. I mean, it was really his grandfather who, you could say, rescued him and is probably more responsible for the life he has now, because he was in Pinpoint. That was his humble beginning. It's a rural settlement, not even a town or city, settled by freed slaves in Georgia outside of Savannah. And it's really a poor community, still 80% poverty there. But because of the accident of a fire, the family ended up moving to Savannah, and it was there that his grandfather gave him what at the time would have been a privilege, raising him through the black Catholic schools. you know, the Catholic schools were segregated like other schools, the public schools in Jim Crow, but they were substantially better. He had the nurturing Franciscan nuns who helped to, you know, develop him and encourage him. And at one point, he was studying to be a priest. Mm-hmm. His grandfather had hoped he would become Savannah's first black priest, and that didn't happen. That was his first encounter with racism in the minor seminary, the high school where young seminarians prepare for the priesthood. And he was the only black student. I mean, you think about this, Kathleen. I mean,
right.
You know, usually if you are someone who is one African-American among in a school, any school, of all white during that time, you pretty much would be a pioneer. I mean, you'd be like, you know, the Little Rock Nine, you know, or Charlene right. Hunter Gold, or any number of the people who had to integrate schools. Well, he basically integrated this school for young seminarians, and they he encountered a lot of racism, including, you know, at night people would say, "Smile, Clarence, so we can see you."
Mm-hmm.
And so this was his first experience. He ended up going to the seminary and leaving that experience and going to the seminary, but dropping out after 1 year because, again, he got to the seminary in Missouri, and on the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated, as he tells the story, there's a seminarian right behind him who says, you know, he overhears saying, you know, "I hope the SOB dies." And
Jeez.
He just couldn't reconcile in his mind that people studying to be priests mm-hmm. would harbor this kind of racism. And so that I'll leave you right there with that.
Right.
That just gives you kind of a picture of what was going on during his young life that may have, you know, seared him early.
Right. Well, let's skip ahead then, because the problem that a lot of us have with Clarence Thomas is that let's skip ahead to Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas,
yes.
which defines his life so much. Because the other problem we have is, could we have a member on the U.S. Supreme Court of all places who lied during his confirmation hearing? It's unresolved.
Yes. Well, I think that you're right. I think that that's certainly an impeachable offense. And I think that if in fact it was discovered that he lied, and particularly as it relates to the Hill allegations, I would not be surprised that if someone would take efforts in the U.S. Congress to try to force an impeachment proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's a very serious thing. I mean, it essentially became a he said, she said,
right.
Allegation. Both of them were very compelling as witnesses on their own behalf, and it really is kind of a mystery. And I would have thought, actually, I would have thought by now there would have been some definitive proof that would have emerged, some diary or some witness or some recantation,
yeah.
There would have been something that would have proved, but both of them had stuck to their stories. Now, what we had done when we revisited the episode in our book was we go back and kind of re-examine it through the lens of the participants in it with 16 years, behind them. And you know, in a lot of different ways, what we found were a lot of people, of course, who voted for Justice Thomas regretting it, and they regretted it enough that would have caused him to certainly go down in defeat if the vote had been taken even like 2 years later.
Hmm, interesting.
And that's a lot of the people felt bamboozled, manipulated, a number of the U.S. senators. In the time since the hearings, one, you know, every just judicial nominee at that level always faces a lot of questions about abortion because it's such a hot button issue. And in the time that since his hearings, the Justice Harry Blackmun's papers, of course, Justice Blackmun is the one that wrote the Roe v. Wade decision that gave women the right to choose, legalized that for women to choose abortion if they so desired. And in his papers, it shows that even Blackmun himself was wondering whether Thomas had told the truth on that question of Roe v. Wade, because he, you know, had said he had never discussed it and never debated it. And, you know, it seemed right after he, you know, something like 6 months after he got onto the court, you know, there was a very big abortion case, and he, of course, voted in the opposition. And so it made people wonder whether or not he had lied on that question. On the question of Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment, what we found is nothing that you could say is conclusive, but what we did find was more context for understanding the allegations. I mean, she talked about crude behavior, sexual in, you know, references, very graphic, pornography, films that he had watched, and we found, you know, pretty good, you know, evidence that he had engaged, you know, he's very, was a connoisseur of pornography, if you will, and some of the comments that Anita Hill alleged that he said, we found that there were classmates of him.
The pubic hair on the coke.
Yes,
right?
that's one of the that's the most, you know, sensational of those. And there was a gentleman, James Millett, who's a classmate of his, never been interviewed before until our book, who recalled a striking a similarity, exact same language, back in the dorm room. In Thomas's room, where he had come over to his dresser and said, you know, hey, you know, went over to the coke can and said, hey, you know, there's a pubic hair on this coke can. Mm-hmm. And everybody at the time thought it was a joke, and Millett recalled saying, hey, it's not mine, you know. Mm-hmm. But when he saw the hearings, he was struck by how exact that was. And there were others we interviewed independently who said that pubic hair on coke can was a common kind of thought that Thomas had. A common phrase, and that he had talked about that before. So, you know, it doesn't prove conclusive, but it just says that, you know, the kind of language that she alleged was not foreign to him.
Yeah. The other thing, and let's talk about this race factor for a moment.
Yeah.
'Cause you talk about this bombshell that he drops during the hearings, and let me quote from this. This is what he said. From my standpoint as a Black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity Blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. It's a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree. Did this come from what he really felt, the disparity of the way African Americans were treated in this country, or was this a calculated comment to get people to vote for him because they were really hit with this race card in such a dramatic fashion?
Well, it certainly froze the committee members, and it certainly was summoning up the most vile kind of racial imagery you could. So it certainly seemed very manipulative. He may have, you know, certainly been angry about that, but it was not. It was not something that was unscripted. Let's say that. According to what Arlen Specter said, we interviewed him, and he says that Thomas told him during an interview for a book that Arlen Specter wrote that dealt with the hearings that it was something that he had thought about. You know that you know he had studied the lynchings, and it was not the spontaneous comment. There also was a very good friend of his in St. Louis, an attorney, who had thought before that, you know, what is happening to Justice Thomas is like a lynching. And he had threatened, he had the idea of going to the federal courthouse square, I think it was, and basically showing, you know, someone with a noose around his neck to dramatize the fact of what was happening to Thomas. He didn't go through with that plan, but the point is that within the Thomas camp and obviously among Thomas himself, the idea that this represented a lynching was already something that had kind of surfaced and had been planted.
Yeah. Why, I know that you repeatedly asked Thomas to talk to you guys,
yes.
and he didn't do it. Why didn't he do it?
Well, I think that for him, I think that, you know, I'm just guessing, I think that we probably represented to him someone who was looking at him in a way that he didn't want to be viewed. I mean, I think looking at him through a racial lens, I mean, we are black journalists and black reporters. We had done a magazine piece about him that really looked at him through, it was kind of the precursor to the book. And I know that his wife did not like that piece very much. I think that she has a great influence on him. I think there was a time when I would have thought that we both thought that Justice Thomas would talk to us. And during the course of our project, he was cordial to us. He was never hostile. We had casual conversation. And there were a couple of different moments that we thought, well, maybe, you know, he would really relent. But I think that there were influences around him. And I think he has a very particularly, I think his wife, to be honest, I think that the trust factor is very low when it comes to the media.
Mm-hmm.
I think they blame the media for particularly the Washington Post, the New York Times, the big outlets that blame them for what happened to him as it relates to the confirmation process. And there's not a level of trust there. So I think that, you know, it was kind of a combination of not blaming the media. I think us looking at him through a racial prison, and that just kind of combined to not to prevent him from talking. I would also add that there probably was no interest in his from his publisher's standpoint. He has a memoir coming out of his own, and there probably wouldn't have been much desire for him to talk to another, you know, to cooperate in another book project when he has his own memoir coming out.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking with the co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Kevin Merida is with us now. Kevin and the co-author of the book, Michael Fletcher, worked for The Washington Post. Kevin is an associate editor at The Washington Post, has been a national political reporter for the paper. He also worked for the Milwaukee Journal. Some of you may remember him in Milwaukee from some years ago. He was here in the 80s. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. What about this label that has been given to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, an Uncle Tom? The authors say the most searing insult a black American can hurl at a member of his or her own race, a synonym for sellout, for someone subservient to whites at the expense of his own people. We'll talk about that, and we'll do that in a moment. And take your phone calls. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Clarence Thomas with one of the authors of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Kevin Merida is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Rick from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I'm interested. You talked a little bit about the research and who you've talked to and some of the issues that you discussed. I'm really curious as to what your conclusions were personally of some of those issues.
Well, I guess it would depend on what the issues are. I mean, I think with as it relates to the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas allegations, I'm really somewhat baffled by it. I mean, I think that there probably is more to the story than either of them let on. You know, as we say, I think that based on all of the testimony that's come across, I think, and what our book suggests is that some of the things that Anita Hill alleged were certainly things that Thomas had said before in his life. And so, you know, leads you to believe that it was certainly possible, you know, very plausible what she said. You know, I think with regard to the other thing we discussed was Roe v. Wade and whether or not he lied there. I think that there has been in the judicial hearing process a careful dance that the nominees go for. It's a very scripted process. They instruct these, you know, there's a whole team of strategists and they practice the questions and they're very artful in how the phrasing, and they try to give themselves just enough wiggle room. I think it was clear that Thomas's intention was to dodge and to not allow himself to be pinned down on questions that might hurt his nomination. And so in the case of whether or not he was against abortion, I think there's probably no doubt that he would have been certainly not in favor of abortion rights, you know. But he was not going to allow himself to be really pinned down in that, because that would be kind of a death knell for him in the committee. So I think that's kind of my view on those two. I don't know if there are other areas that you want to explore.
Those are the two main ones. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk for a moment about Thurgood Marshall, because we got this comparison, and their differences couldn't be more stark in some areas. I was interested. I was not aware that Thurgood Marshall, at a PAC news conference, you write about this, on the day he submitted his resignation, before 4 days before Bush tapped Thomas to replace him, he's asked whether or not the president should name an African-American to succeed the court's lone other one. Marshall says Bush should not use race as a cover to put the wrong Negro on the court. My dad told me way back there is no difference between a white snake and a black snake. They'll both bite.
Well, there was no question that in a number of his clerks that we interviewed, yes, there was no question of what Justice Marshall's intention was. There was already the news circulating that Thomas was going to be on the short list, and he was trying to signal that he didn't really think that you ought to be wary of Thomas. Thurgood Marshall was not happy that Justice Thomas took his seat. That shouldn't come as any surprise to anybody. And Thomas, for his part, you know, who's very much of a politician. I mean, he, at times when it was to his advantage, he criticized Justice Marshall. And a very famous, during the bicentennial, he went out of his way. Here he is at the EEOC as chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and takes the occasion to criticize Thurgood Marshall for a speech he had given, in which Thurgood Marshall just pointed out that, you know, we're celebrating, you know, the Constitution, the history of this country, but for a while, African Americans weren't part of this country and weren't given the rights, and it seemed like a perfectly reasonable speech, and Thomas went out of his way to criticize Marshall. But when it was time for his confirmation, you know, he praised Marshall, and he talked about his role as a civil rights pioneer, and even after he visited, you know, when he paid his courtesy calls to the various justices, he had a two-hour session with Marshall, and it was very cordial. And Thomas used that session to talk about, you know, what a great time he had and the affinity, so that he was trying to draw close to Marshall. And even though, you know, Marshall was certainly capable of trading tales and jokes and that kind of thing and stories of the South, he was not the same. He didn't stand for the same thing that Thomas did for him. He was very unhappy about his replacement.
Yeah. Let's go to Melvin from Duluth next. Hi, Melvin.
Eldon?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It's Eldon. But, I was just kind of curious, because it seems like with so many prominent African-American conservative leaders, Colin Powell, Clarence Thomas, and some of these types, that in some people's eyes, it's just not okay to be African American and conservative. And I just curious of what your thoughts are on whether a number of people's opinions are based solely on that fact, that since a larger number of African Americans are more liberal, that it's not okay to be African American and conservative.
Good question.
Well, that's one of the contentions of Justice Thomas, that he is a lot of the hostility toward him is simply because he holds the views that he holds, and that he doesn't, people think that because he is black, he does not have a right to think for himself. You know, interestingly enough, Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, who would have been more the late Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, who was for a number of years someone who was on short list to be a Supreme Court justice himself, and it maybe had hoped that he would fill Thurgood Marshall's seat. He became kind of Justice Thomas's public castigator. And as Judge Lake A. Leon Higginbotham said, Thomas has a right to think for himself, but he does not have a right to be free of critique. And so I think that what you have now in the country is that you have, unlike some periods in history, there have always been conservatives in black communities, even people who are commonly not thought of as conservatives, people like Louis Farrakhan. You can go all the way back to Frederick Douglass, Zora Neale Hurston, the great, you know, writer who at you know, various times was not for segregation. I mean, not for desegregation at the time, and was often, you know, thought of as someone who had too many, you know, white patrons. You know, Booker T. Washington, of course, was, you know, founded a black university that stands today, Tuskegee, and at one point was the most popular black man in the country. He was a very conservative. And so there's throughout history there have been people with conservative ideas, but there seems to be now more of an isolation by those conservatives, and that there's not that many who are out debating those ideas, and it certainly is true that more African Americans vote Democratic. The Democratic Party gets, you know, 90% of black votes still.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's happened is someone like Justice Thomas is not really engaged in debate about him, or engaged in debate about his ideas. So he's not really out in black communities debating at forums, exchanging ideas, and I think that serves to create this polarization.
I mean, the guy officiated at Rush Limbaugh's wedding, for heaven's sake. Of course he's going to be a polarizing figure.
Yeah, so I think that part of it would be, you know, there have been conservatives before. We write about this in the final chapter. I think it's a very good question your caller has.
It is, yeah.
And we write about this in the final chapter, the kind of expectations that high-achieving African-Americans face, no matter who you are. And I think that Thomas labors under that he's only the second African-American in what is the, you know, the highest rung in American jurisprudence. So, of course, people have a lot of expectations of him. And you know, I would think that if you feel strongly about your ideas and you think that they're right, then go out and engage the debate about them.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Talk about his, you know, just some personal anecdotes, because we don't know very much about him. He seems to be just so quiet, so silent. You talk in the book about children, and in children he sees uncluttered minds, fresh possibilities, hope, the hope that maybe they won't prejudge him, won't view him through the lens of their elders. And so he'll strike up conversations with children and invite them to his chambers, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's known to be one of the most accessible justices. In fact, one of the best streams of reporting we have for the book were the number of people who have come to visit him, whether they were school children that he saw who were at the court and he invited them up, or whether they were, you know, there's the case of a student who was a high achiever at a high school that was written about, Cedric Jennings. His story became a book, Hope in the Unseen, by Ron Suskind. And, you know, Thomas read the series in the Wall Street Journal, invited the kid to the chambers, and talked to him about his college choices. And so there are numerous tales like that. Thomas has always been someone willing to share his knowledge. He goes to schools. He's been in the Washington, D.C. area and in places all around the country. You'll see sometimes in public school settings, you know, homes for the boys, you know, boys' home, underprivileged kids. He does a lot of that. So I think that, you know, he is somebody who does have a heart in that way. I mean, he's raising his own great nephew, That's the son of a nephew who's serving 30 years in prison on federal drug charges. He took him from down in Pinpoint in Georgia and is raising him himself as kind of a second son. So he really is somebody who is easy to get to know if you get to see him up close. And you know, he's not very good when it comes to reaching out, when it comes to speeches and that like, but in very close quarters, people often find themselves surprised at the Thomas that they meet.
Mm-hmm. And yet you also start the book with a group of black fourth and fifth graders from this private academy in Savannah, Georgia. He's there for the dedication of a library where he spent most of his free time when he was a kid, a very important place to him. And he gets this encounter from a retired educator. Tell me about that incident and why you started your book with that.
Well, the incident occurred when he was in town in Savannah to give a speech, I believe, at the Savannah Chamber of Commerce. And so he had some free time. One of his friends from Savannah called him up at his hotel room and said, well, why don't you, if you have some time, why don't you come over to the Bull Street Library downtown? It's been renovated and wanted to, you know, go show you and give you a quick tour. And so he went, and he, as you pointed out, he saw the school children, and he's going around as Thomas does, and he talks to the genealogy specialist and speaks to the security people, and he's always friendly like that. And there's another former neighborhood guy who was there with his friend. So, you know, it's kind of like a combination of he's touring the library, he's remembering all of the things from his childhood, he's with some of his friends, and it's a really nice occasion. And then he gets upstairs, and there's this woman, a retired educator who is a local activist, and she sees them. This is an accidental encounter. And she just comes up to them, and I guess she's struck by the picture of them all together, and they're sharing childhood stories and laughing. And she said, I just wanted to see what a group of Uncle Toms looked like.
Oh, yeah.
And so it really caught them off guard. It embarrassed Lester Johnson, who was the friend that called Justice Thomas up in the first place, and he was really angry. He had done battle with the activists before, but Thomas kind of laughed it off later and told his friend, you know, who is that, one of your irate clients? But we led the book with it because it seemed to be kind of represented all of the strands of Thomas's life, you know, his fondest childhood memories, you know, which are still very important to him, even though some of them torture him. But books were very important to him. It's how he kind of escaped, and it's how he would kind of, you know, dream his big thoughts.
Sure.
And he was an avid reader. And when seeing the school kids represented kind of the hope for the future, and yet at any given time, this kind of thing could happen to him. Not that when he goes out, people always call him Uncle Thomas, but the idea that he is a controversial figure, and he knows that, especially among black Americans, there are a great many people who don't like him.
Yeah. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Kevin Merida is with us, co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas, recently released. Kevin is associate editor at the Washington Post, and our number 800-486-8655. Roger from Madison, the next caller. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Good morning, and thanks for having this show. I'm calling because I recall very poignantly during the confirmation hearings Clarence Thomas talking about how he would sit at the window in his office in the courthouse and see the prisoners being taken off the bus and led into the courtroom and feeling that there, but for the grace of God, he was. And then I was struck by the inconsistency I felt some years later reading the advance sheets in a case where one of the more liberal justices who was in the minority on the question was rebuking his colleagues for not taking any conditions of confinement cases. He recited in the particular case where they had refused to grant certiorari conditions and things that the prisoner had been subject to that were, if anything, just very short of Abu Ghraib. And Thomas, writing in defense of the majority, kind of said, well, you know, nobody should expect that a prison is going to be a nice place to be, and they did the crime, and therefore they've got to do the time, and they shouldn't complain about whatever happens to them in prison. Has anybody looked at his attitude toward conditions of confinement cases?
Yeah. In fact, we have some of that in our book. I think that you know, the call is very astute about that. Many people remember that comment of Thomas. He could look out of his Court of Appeals office, and there, but the grace of God go I. Many people have referred to that, and they've noticed that he's been very tough on defendants in a whole range of cases, not only as it relates to prison conditions, certainly, but just in terms of things like on death penalty cases. He routinely rejects them regardless of what the evidence, death penalty appeal cases, even when there are good grounds, things like the racism in the jury pool system, even when there's documented evidence that a criminal defendant deserves another hearing, he's been very tough on defendants. In the case of there's a famous case, of course, that we spent a lot of time on, Hudson versus McMillan, in which an inmate was brutally beaten by guards, and Thomas rejected, and he appealed to the Supreme Court that his Eighth Amendment rights, the cruel, unusual punishment, were violated, and Thomas said that did not meet the standards of cruel and unusual punishment. Even he said it may have been, you know, wrong for them to beat him, but it didn't measure up to that. And it seemed to be a certain cold-heartedness that's existed with him with regard to criminal defendants. And that's an interesting thing, because not only, you know, was there the scene in the confirmation hearing, but his own family has experienced some of that. I mean, his nephew is serving 30 years in prison on federal drug trafficking charges, and he, you know, we had the first interview with him. He's in prison, in federal prison. He was caught up in a sting in Pinpoint, the place that Thomas grew up, that also nabbed one of the sons of Thomas's closest cousin, and there just seemed to be a sense that, you know, not a lot of sympathy for those in the criminal justice system. In fact, his nephew said that he can barely even mention that Thomas is his uncle because something bad might happen to him in prison.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Kevin Merida is with us, co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with the co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. Kevin Merida is our guest, and he is associate editor at The Washington Post. Has been a national political reporter, done all kinds of writing, was at the Journal here in Milwaukee back in the 1980s. Yeah, I wanted to be sure to ask you about this. Going beyond the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings here, what you write in the book, what seems undeniable is that episode has framed the rest of his, Clarence Thomas's, life. He has not been the same man since. Some believe the scars of that ordeal have affected his judicial judgment, making him more rigid in his deliberation of cases than he might otherwise have been. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I want to first say, Kathleen, that I loved being in Milwaukee. You know, it was right.
Great.
After I got out of college. It was my first job.
Oh, really?
It was back when the Milwaukee Journal was an afternoon paper, and I loved being, you know, I loved going to the fish fries on Fridays, and, you know, I loved being in the lakefront and walking to work. I used to live on the lake, and, you know, loved being in Milwaukee. It was a great, great town, and I have a lot of fond memories there.
Good, good.
I think that what has happened to Thomas is that, and he has certainly denied this and says that, you know, he's over this and people make a lot to do this. But what we found in our research and talking to a number of friends is that he still lives with this experience. And I know Dick Armey, who's the former House Majority Leader, describes in our book a scene in Thomas's kitchen. And they were talking about, talking about life and how Thomas was discussing, how when he worries that when he gets older and that he will never be able to escape this, that his obit, his grandchildren, if he has them, will see, in his obit high up that he was accused of sexual harassment by a former employee. And Army talks about these as tattoos, and that's what they were talking about that night over the kitchen table, is that there are these labels that exist that you're stuck with,
right,
that you can never lose. He's still very angry about it. Some of the people who've come to his chambers, he still talks about, he has a list in his head of who was for him and against him. He still holds grudges against those who were against him. He believes that he was the product in some ways of a number of what he calls elite blacks, who were, those of privileged backgrounds, leaders that really were out to get him because he was not like them. And he holds grudges against a lot of the liberal activist organizations. And so, when you have a lot of anger inside of you, there's not a lot of place to go for alternative opinions. So what we have and what people have talked about is just that I think when he got onto the court, and people may have forgotten this, many of your listeners may have forgotten this, is that when he came to the court by the, confirmed by the lowest margin, incidentally, the smallest margin in 100 years.
52-48?
Yeah, in over 100 years, that in the black community, at least, more people supported him than not. A majority of African-Americans supported him, even after the Anita Hill portion. That changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a sense that, among African-Americans, among many, that, once he got to the court, and many people said this, once he gets to the court and he's, free from, he had a tenure position, that his experience of growing up in the Jim Crow South, in black communities, his family background, some of that will kick in and it will allow him to kind of have a broader perspective on things. People had hoped that, but there's really no hope anymore from people on that. I mean, he's really just kind of hardened. He's not very receptive to alternative points of view, and I think that he's become more isolated in many ways. And so I think that, I think that those who are looking for any change in Clarence Thomas, like a Hugo Black or somebody whose background was one thing and then they became evolved into a different kind of justice, I don't think that anyone should expect that from Justice Thomas. I think that the only thing that possibly could change is if there's some way that he is propelled to go out and debate his ideas and therefore, engages alternative points of view. Because right now what you see from Thomas is you don't see a person really even interested in alternative points of view and even in considering them.
Yeah. Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Hi. Either just John Paul Stevens, either. The interesting thing about Clarence Thomas is that expectation right there. People had a different expectation, almost to the point of wanting him to be a legislator as opposed to a Supreme Court justice. And I think the problem people have with Thomas, going back to the beginning of your book when the woman called him an Uncle Tom, has more to do with the fact that he's a black conservative than anything else, because he doesn't fit the mold. He doesn't fit the little box that people expect a black judge to be in. They don't expect him to be conservative like he is. And I want to go back to Kathleen's point about him being such a polarizing figure. That depends on your definition. Conservatives don't find him to be polarizing. Liberals find him to be polarizing, just as conservatives find Hillary Clinton to be polarizing, but liberals don't. So there's two sides to the story. I think he's in a difficult position, predominantly because he is a black conservative more than anything else.
You see, and to me, that's not troubling to me. To me, what's troubling about him is the fact that he's on the U.S. Supreme Court, and he may have lied in a very significant way during his confirmation hearing. Yeah, that's troubling to me.
But people call him an Uncle Tom. That has nothing to do with him lying. Maybe. See, the thing is, it's troubling to you, but you don't know if he lied. But you're troubled.
I know. There's still that question. Right. I don't think it was definitively answered.
Right. But the point is, things shouldn't trouble us unless we know for sure. If he did lie, it would trouble me. The fact that I don't know that he lied doesn't trouble me. Because there's nothing I can do about it. And the fact that it bothers people, it troubles them because of that potential, kind of tends to give you the direction that person is thinking. I'm not troubled by the fact that, because I don't know if he lied or not, so there's no reason for it to actually trouble me. I should be troubled by the facts that I have, if something is true or false. Not the fact that I shouldn't be troubled by a maybe.
Mm-hmm. Kevin.
Well, I think that the caller makes an excellent point about the expectations. And as I said, we deal with this in a very complex way in the final chapter of the book. I think that, yes, there is, I think, in part because of the history of African-Americans and the struggle in this country, that there has fairly or unfairly been an expectation that history should always be, that one's experiences should inform. I mean, the truth is that you know, there is no real, you know, kind of objective judgeships. I mean, there's no scientific way to practice the craft of judging, you know. You know, everybody will say, and Thomas will say, well, you know, I just adhere strictly to the Constitution, but you know, it just depends on what the case is and how you interpret what the framers were intending. And if you look at Thomas's rules, he doesn't go strictly. It's a very kind of it's a very careful consideration, and every person on that court uses different ways to assess it. We all kind of a product of our experiences and how those experiences, you know, play into our professional and personal lives. I think that many blacks expect certain things of him, and I'm not here to judge whether that's fair or not. I think one of the things that most hampers him is simply coming behind Thurgood Marshall, and I think that Thurgood Marshall is more responsible probably than any human being in history for the legal dismantling of Jim Crow. I mean, he came before the court as a lawyer, I think 32 times, won 29 cases. I mean, I think in a time when it was very difficult to win cases, some of those cases, and I think that there is a certainly a reverence of what he accomplished and a sense of him being a champion of civil rights and recognized in minority, you know, majority voting rights districts, the things that are seem to be the pillars of equality and justice, that he stood for those, and that there's a feeling that Thomas does not. Now, so in part, I think that the caller is correct that when people call him Uncle Tom, they are expressing a point of view about in certain respects, about politics and about how they think someone should think personally. But again, I want to go back to the idea that there have been conservatives, black conservatives in the country. So I don't want people to think that that you can't be a black conservative. Maybe black conservatives find themselves on the out, but I think that has to be a lot to do with what kind of black conservative you are. I mean, I think Colin Powell was somebody, many people would probably call him a moderate and not a black conservative, but he certainly was a Republican, and he was someone who was associated with conservative Republican administrations, and he's somebody who was revered, you know, probably could have been the first black president elected. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a sense that Colin Powell was someone who stood for things. He says that he was a product of affirmative action. It's not really you know, worried about what other people think about his how he got to be where he is. I think that in Thomas's biography, a lot of there's a sense of hypocrisy there, and that a sense that he has benefited from his race in almost every turn of his life, and yet doesn't really kind of own up to that, and doesn't really see that those considerations for others.
Yeah. On that note, we have to say goodbye. I'm so glad you wrote about him. You gave his life, you used that phrase, careful consideration, and I think that that's what you've done with him. And it's just, it's a good read, and somebody needed to pay attention to him. So I'm glad you did it. Thanks.
It was my pleasure.
Kevin Merida, he is the co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. It has just recently been published by Doubleday. His co-author is Michael Fletcher. Kevin and Michael both work for The Washington Post. Kevin is an associate editor at The Washington Post, has been a national political reporter, a feature writer for the Style section, and a columnist for their Sunday magazine. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.